a Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everybody, Noons here. Great to have you with us. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco, coming to you from V8 Sleuth headquarters, world headquarters in Melbourne, Australia. Great to have you with us as we take a look at a classic car episode, and this one, in my mind, is the car that made the Holden Racing Team.
The car has garnered plenty of interest and Team Holden have given little away. In its debut performance, it's been outstanding.
Fantastic job by Lance to win this one.
He's going to win it and win it easily, Bradley. For 10 seconds as he takes the checkered flag to win Heat 1. Round 6 of the Shell Australian Touring Car Championship. Absolute daylight back to second position.
And at this stage, I'd ask Ross Brody, the motorsport manager for Shell, to present today's trophy to the new Australian Touring Car Champion, Craig Lowndes.
Let's watch them as they go down the main straight. Lowndes alongside. This is the best position he's been in the last 10 laps. Can he take it on the inside? Season is outright struggling. Lowndes has done it. So Craig Lowndes in car number one has gone through to regain the lead. Listen to the crowd here at Sandown.
Breaking for final time through Caltech's chase. One more corner to come up. Lowndes will get on that middle pedal, brake and swing on to pit straight. Crowd cheering him on, 46,000 fans. He gives a wave and he points it up toward the checkered flag, and Craig Lowndes wins the 1996 AMP Bathurst 1000. And surprise, surprise, the crew are ecstatic.
It's my pleasure to welcome the two winning drivers and to present the trophy. Craig Lowndes and Greg Murphy driving a great Holden race car.
Brings back memories, doesn't it? The Holden Racing Team's Commodore VR that clean swept, well, took the Triple Pete in 1996, the Australian Touring Car Championship, Sandown 500 and the Bathurst 1000, the car that really put Craig Lowndes into a whole another stratosphere, a guy who was in his own stratosphere of supercar sleuthing. Will Dale, welcome along to the pod this week as we cover off a car that is unbelievably special. It is very much earning of its right as a classic car.
Oh, absolutely. It was very much arriving at the absolute right time. A whole heap of different factors all coming together to finally propel a team that had was actually in at dire risk of not being a team anymore less than 12 months prior. And it really launched it into what turned out to be a dynasty of success.
And your comment's an important one, because the Holden Racing Team that had been run by TWR Australia had, well, really been under the gun, because they'd not won a championship. They hadn't won Bathurst since that first one in 1990, so much so that there was pressure on Holden pulling the pin on them and taking the factory support and sending it elsewhere to Fred Gibson's team, which was chatted about at the time. 1996 was the third year of a three-year contract, and they managed to get the stay of execution to get that year in, and it was Bathurst, it was the right year to get in, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, because Bathurst 1995, let's not forget, was an absolute was something I don't think HRT would ever want to relive or think about ever again.
It's probably their darkest day, just about. I mean, 97 Bathurst, where none of the cars finished, is probably equal, being Brock's last.
06 wasn't particularly good either.
No, that wasn't good either.
But on both those two occasions, they had a fair idea going into the race that their car would probably make the finish, whereas in 95, they had a fair idea they probably wouldn't make the first pit stop.
And that is how it played out. So in 1996, the Holden Racing Team replaced Thomas Mesura, and you can hear Thomas's story on our V8 Sleuth podcast. His episode is still one of the most talked about podcast in Australian motorsport, and indeed on the V8 Sleuth podcast. He was a long-termer at the Holden Racing Team. He'd been there since 1992, but John Crennan made the call to shake it up, to axe Thomas, keep him as an endurance driver, and put Craig Lowndes into the seat, who had been a co-driver for a couple of years at the Holden Racing Team for the endurance races, alongside Peter Brock in the 05 Commodore. Of course, the famous 05, he'd come there in 94. He brought Mobil with him, helped give He helped give HRT legitimacy. Now you can see why I tripped over it. And then in 96, we went into a whole other stratosphere, and it was this car, the car that they called the supercar at the time, when the category wasn't supercars or V8 supercars. It was Group A touring cars. It was 5-litre touring cars. It was the V8s. It was, as Tony Cochran always said, you know, Group A sounded like a blood type, not a racing category. But we got the V8 supercar thing rolling later in 1996. But this was the car that Auto Action magazine dubbed the supercar, and it kind of stuck. But the title was apt.
Well, it's hard to disagree. And in this particular era, we were, what, 3 years down the road, three, four seasons down the road of 5-litre V8 touring car rules. This was a time when teams were starting to cotton on to the whole idea of using computer-aided design, putting a lot of engineering theory or more and more engineering theory and analysis into the design of roll cages and making the cars stiffer to create a platform that they could get consistent setups and tire stuff from. And this car had a very, very, very visible feature that was evident of that.
And it kind of is what the car is dubbed. I mean, it's called the supercar in some instances, the petty bar car, because this horizontal bar that ran through basically the front passenger side of the car, named after Richard Petty, who had something like that in a NASCAR many moons ago. And in the States, they dubbed it the petty bar. So it kind of, you know, you hear people talk of this Craig Lowndes car being called the petty bar car, and that's indeed why. But you know the really ironic part of this, that it's distinguishing feature. On the outside, it looked the same paint scheme as the car that Craig started the 1996 season in, that white and deep dark blue that I reckon was one of the great HRT liveries of all time. Ironic, given it wasn't a red car, which we associate the Holden Racing Team and Holden and GM with the red side of the fence in this country, but it wasn't a red car at all. But it was inside, and it was that bar. And you know the ironic part there? When you talk to the guys involved, George Smith from Denkar, who built that chassis back in the day, of course, Denkar were the HRT chassis supplier. They did it for other teams and became exclusive to HRT a few years after this car was built. But you know what he said? It didn't make 1% difference. So they actually put this roll cage, which was the first, as you said before, the computer-aided design was really coming in then. So that's the first HRT car that was designed on computer. So they actually put the flex, put this bar and the design on the flex test rig to measure the percentage gains and get an idea of what they were in for here. Because what we saw with these cars of the era, everyone was focused, as you said, on this, on the chassis rigidity and making them stronger and stiffer so they won't roll and they won't be lazy and they'll be more direct. So the more stiffness, the more rigidity, the better. So the, all the bars started getting added into cars after this. Everyone had a theory on what to do. But they left the bar in, even though they found that it didn't really do anything, because the other element was it was the thing that the opposition got transfixed by. So they weren't looking at some of the other things that this car actually had. So it was the perfect decoy, and it's a mental advantage too, because talking to Craig Lowndes about this car in previous years, he said, look, it was presented to me as better. So it was just as much a mental game as anything. Hey, Craig, this car's better. It's got this bar. It's a rocket ship. Cool. Because he's at that period where he's, what, 21? And he's just fast. He doesn't really give a toss. But you tell him it's faster. Sure, it's faster. I'll go drive it faster. He drives it faster.
I see. He's got 2 years' experience in super, in a supercar by that point in terms of like how much knowledge he has of feel and all that sort of thing. Maybe, yeah.
You can talk yourself into things if you really need to. But the other thing was, it was just as much a psych out for the opposition. So I remember too, when they bowled that car out at Calder for the first race meeting it did in 1996, they had covers all over it, like a shroud.
It just went over the glass. It wasn't a full car cover or anything.
It was just the glass, so you couldn't see into the bar work. So they actually had Craig peeping out a peephole to be able to drive it along, and there's photos of it. We've got them of it on the dummy grid. Because in those, you know, of course, Calder in those days, as it is now, the garages were out the back. You had to drive the car out to the dummy grid and then out to the pit lane. So really trying to keep it a secret, and just as many mind games. And people talk about gamesmanship in supercars. I know Scafie talks about it a lot in the telecast. I reckon that term gets overused and probably not accurately applied in a lot of instances. That was gamesmanship 101.
Absolutely. And of course, by that point in the season, Craig was the championship leader. He'd sort of come out of nowhere, because everyone knew what he was capable, or everyone had seen what he was capable of. Bathurst 94, the endurance races 95. On pole at Sandown, on pole at Bathurst. But then to come out at the start of the season and really win a lot of races and shake up the established order of what people thought was a good driver and who was good and all of that, he had a quite big target on his back.
And I don't think anyone really penciled him in as the favourite going into that season.
No.
He created clearly created headlines by becoming a full-time driver, of course, teaming up with Peter Brock. And, you know, there was his name was in lights from what he'd done those previous couple of years.
Mm.
But John Bauer was the reigning champion. There was, you know, Russell Ingall was arriving to drive with Larry Perkins. Glenn Seaton was a factor.
Mm.
Mark Scaife was struggling a little bit for money for Gibson Motorsport. But I don't think anyone had Craig Lowndes tagged in as championship favourite. But round one Eastern Creek, once that was out of the way, he was straight up there. Wins at Sandown. At Bathurst, he clashes with Wayne Gardner and draws the ire of the former motorcycle world champion. And then at Phillip Island, has a monster. He and John Bauer off the track. Actually, you know what? Let's get the audio of it, of what unfolded at Phillip Island in the next round of the championship. On the opening lap with John Bauer and Craig Lowndes.
But Craig Lowndes, John Bauer, though, has latched onto his tail and will not let...
Oh, he's
Lowndes is off!
And so's Bauer.
Well, that's remarkable.
Big accident.
There was no touch there.
That's a big accident.
Oh, it is a bad one. That is John Bauer. Now, there didn't appear to be any touch between those cars at all.
No, but I think that maybe there was some oil on the road there, or Craig has gone off and Bauer's jumped on the brakes to try and avoid the accident, and he's gone off as well. He's had a hard break, maybe locked a brake. We won't know until we see them.
Sensation here. The first lap, the second heat. John Bauer, okay, out of the car and walking away.
So by hearing and listening to that audio again, you probably have as good an idea of how big John Bauer's crash was as anyone who watched The Vision, as there isn't any vision.
It was huge all round. I mean, it wrote off Bauer's car. It severely smashed Lowndes' car. And that helped fast-track the brand-new car for him to run next time out. The funny thing was, actually, when you think about it, the supercar car had already been testing. It was built and ready to go. It wasn't just quick, let's hurriedly finish it now. Mm. It had already been out on track. Of course, they had to implement it as a race car for the Calder round of the championship because, well, they needed a car. And they
couldn't just turn up with no car for the championship leader.
Yeah, small problem. Yeah. Minor issue. But there were a couple of things. So I remember that car rolling out in testing, and Auto Action had the photos, and it kind of had mismatched panels on it, and it was kind of being treated as a low-key, you know, roll it out, because the teams used to always go out to Calder and the testing restrictions weren't like they are now. So if they had something to do, they'd just go out to Calder and drive around and bed in brakes or try to, you know, give someone some laps, whether it was the regular driver or a kid like Lowndes had done a few years earlier. So it was very open compared to it is now. The concept of a team going testing is big news because it just doesn't really happen very much. So AA instantly dubbed it the supercar because you can see the bars. You can see that this thing's a little bit different. But the bits you couldn't see that were different. So remember that the year before, Thomas Mesereau had a crash at Phillip Island in the wet in a brand new car, which actually was the car that Craig started the 96 season in. And because of the way that they mounted the pedals in those cars at the time, they actually were like the pendant-shaped pedals that hung down. So when he crashes, his legs go clattering around and they smack into the pedals and the arms of the pedals that come down into the driver footwell.
Mm.
So for this car, they actually created floor-mounted pedals in a carbon fiber shroud so it would keep the driver's legs, you know, sort of in check in the case of an accident. We saw that later, of course, with, you know, all the stuff we've got now with wraparound seats and the netting that went down the side the driver's left arm, and now we've got with... In the wake of the Chas Mostert crash with his busted leg at Bathurst, there was that leg protection there alongside the gear shift in the modern car. So that was the bit you couldn't see in those photos of what was going on there, because that was a bit of a safety thing as well. And, you know, it would keep the feet in, but it was because of the roll cage bars of this car, you couldn't mount the pedals like you had the previous cars because it was so different. They used 15 kilos more roll cage in this new car than the previous cars. And you can look at those previous cars and wonder where the cage is because it's so minimal compared to, I mean, and this was the start of it. And then from there, the teams evolved their cage designs down the track. But this one really accelerated that and took it from, you know, 0.1 to 0.10 and everything after that was 11, 12, 13.
Oh, absolutely. It turned into a real arms race after this. I mean, you see in the early 2000s, we've got the Larry bar, we've got the Gary bar, we've got double
everyone,
hoop cages.
Got it's, a bar after
yeah, the, exactly. After the X bar.
But
yeah, this car really set the tone for where supercars were going to head from that in the next 10 years.
And it was really at a time when, and I know that they took some inspiration from the DTM and ITC cars at the time. Remember,
oh,
the
those DTM were remarkable pieces of machinery.
The
yeah.
Mercedes, the Opels, the Alfa Romeos that spawned out of DTM and created an International Touring Car Championship that ran, you know, it was basically the DTM, but a separate series running around Europe and in various other places. So Chris Dye was there at the time. He was a young engineer who went to Arrows Formula One after he worked with Craig, went to Ferrari for a very long time and worked with Michael Schumacher and Kimi Raikkonen. And he's now at Alpine, actually, in Formula One and spent some time in DTM, I think it was, with BMW, didn't
yes.
he?
So,
you know, he was there at the time. So you got an idea of the caliber of people who are working towards creating something really, really special. And then out it rolls. And, I mean, look at the – I mean, it only started 36 races in its whole career. But for mine, it's the greatest Holden Racing Team car of all time.
Well, that's a big call.
I think it's the car that made the Holden Racing Team. It took it – all right, I'm going to back this up now. Okay, Mark Scaife's Golden Child, amazing car, lots of wins, two Bathurst wins, Clipsals, you know, Bannerhead.
Yeah.
It took him to – a championship in 02, did the sort of second part of 01, you know, yeah, look, it's right up there in the greatest V8 supercars of all time. But the team was already up. The team was already dominant. Its achievements, it got the Golden Child nickname. It's a special car. But to me, this is the car that made the Holden Racing Team. It took it from the second, third, fourth runners that had not really fulfilled the promise that they showed, and went wham. It went smash. It went, we're here to play. We're not here to stuff around. This is serious. We're taking it down that path there. Come and catch us. And that's what it did. And it all came together at the right time. Lowndes goes from this kid who the motor racing public know. He was on 60 Minutes, for Christ's sake, in 1996. That was a big deal. That's a massive, you know, we're talking before social media, YouTube, streaming.
Before we regularly got live touring car races shown on TV.
Lots of options for viewing. That was massive in terms that 60 Minutes viewed Craig Lowndes, this wonder kid of Australian touring car racing, as a worthy story subject on a primetime flagship show on a network that didn't even show the Australian Touring Car Championship or the Bathurst 1000. And then it does what the Golden Child never did. Championship.
Yep.
Sandown 500. Now, granted, Golden Child couldn't do it because the race was at Queensland, but I mean, you know, could have won the Queensland 500 as well and the Bathurst 1000. It got the triple threat in 1 year. Golden Child didn't do that. And I think just what it did for that team in its legitimacy, in its rise, in its history, that's, you know, Brock helped step it up. Mobile, bit more funding. Yep, definitely. But this one moved the marker like nothing else in the team's history.
Well, you couldn't script a redemption arc like this. It would be too implausible. No, the team would then come out and steamroll everyone.
The graph can't go up that quickly in the script, can it?
No. And you look at the competition results of this car. As we talked about, debuted at Calder Park. It took pole position and won its very first race. Then it actually had, was it a differential failure?
Did the diff in the second race, yeah.
Which actually cost Craig the championship lead. John Bow left Calder with a championship lead.
Which was amazing considering the dominance that Craig had had over the year to that point. And, of course, JB was in a spare car. So Craig gets a brand new freshie and JB gets an old one.
Yes. But then we talk about dominance. So from Lakeside, which was the next round, three races, three wins for Craig. Barbagallo, the next round, pole position, three races, three wins for Craig.
And these are the days of the 20-minute sprint races start where you finish the previous race.
And then Malala, the penultimate round, three races, two wins for Craig, but in the last one, he seals the Touring Car Championship.
With a dinged car.
With a very dinged car.
So wasn't that the one where down at the hairpin, one of the hairpins, I can't remember which one's
end
which,
of the back.
Northern
yeah.
hairpin, or the, I can't remember what they're
the
called.
The first hairpin.
Yeah, the first
no,
hairpin.
Sorry, the second
the
hairpin,
because
there's
actually,
like a few
end
of them,
the curving back straight.
Yeah.
Is he and John Bauer fighting? Alan Jones loses the rear end and wipes Craig out on the way through. Is that how it went from memory?
And Bow goes as well. Yeah.
He got both of them on the way through.
Yeah.
And actually, such was the damage didn't look like much to Craig's car. He did finish. He finished fifth, but I think that's the race Wayne Gardner
correct.
Won. And Stevie Richards finished second as a privateer, which blew everyone away.
Mm.
But that the damage to the Craig Lowndes supercar actually took Thomas Mesner out of the Oran Park final round, because the plan was that HRT were going to run three cars. They were entered Thomas in 016.
That was going to be my next question as to what number Thomas was 16. Going to run.
Well, I think it was 16, actually. Hmm. But, of course, that meant that Craig had to go back to his repaired Phillip Island crash car for the final round at Oran Park. So the supercar was parked up, repaired, and readied, of course, for the endurance races. It's actually an interesting one here. And we were so lucky when we did the Holden Racing Team book a few years ago, the second edition of that book with revised chapters, updated imagery, in the same format as the Perkins Engineering book and the DJR book. It's going to be arriving. It's in pre-order sale now. If you haven't ordered a copy, jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. You can read all about this car, and I think it's 44 other cars off the top of my head.
Yes.
It arrives in stock late June, early July. So don't miss out. It's an absolute corker. It's the next book in the trilogy. Well, it's a trilogy now with those two other books of Perkins and DJR. But the thing is that, so although this was not a Peter Brock race car, this was Craig Lowndes' car, Brocky and Thomas Mesner both tested it at Calder when they were, you know, trying each other's cars, seeing what they felt like, seeing what the setups were, which we were able to find out through the paperwork from the Holden Racing Team history, which Ben Eggleston had acquired and kept. So he's been able to keep the history of the Holden Racing Team, given he's got a lot of the cars, including this one, which we'll talk about soon. But it was able, you could show, it was all listed. They'd noted on the day which driver drove which car, when, where, why, and how. So those little nuggets of history are cool. But then Lowndes drove the Brock car at Oran Park at the last round after he's busted.
Mm.
So he took over Brock's to go and do his victory donuts and burnouts on the pit straight. So if you ever see a photo of 05 spinning the rear tyres, smoke everywhere.
With some young grinning bloke from Oran Park 96,
It's not PB, it's CL, being an absolute kid. Because after all, he is the kid. So that car, Mrs. Oran Park, Greg Murphy, of course, is the co-driver for the endurance races. They go out at the Sandown 500, but they got their, well, not wings clip, but their front under tray clip before they even got there.
Yeah, a little bit of a snip-snip. Ironically, it was like 12 months on from when the Ford Falcon had also had an under tray trim due to the perceived performance advantage that that car had over the VR Commodore. Ironically, 12 months later, after a season where the HRT cars had largely dominated, the same treatment was given to the Commodores, which I think was 125 mil off the front under tray, which really upset all the other Commodore runners who said, no, it's HRT doing a really good job with really good Bridgestone tyres. Mm. You're killing the rest of us. But
yeah, it's not a Commodore thing. It's a HRT thing.
Yes.
And so much so that that's why Larry Perkins wheeled out the VP for Bathurst that wasn't subject to the under tray trim. And then there was also the issue of Craig Lowndes' issue before Bathurst. So Sandown, they blitz. He and Greg Murphy win the race. They lead 122 of 161 laps.
But it was a very late pass for the lead.
It was, and it was cool because I was there that day. So Lowndes and Seaton, the future FPR teammates, if you told everyone at that stage in 1996 that 7 years later they'd be teammates at a factory Ford team, people would have laughed at you. More so about Craig driving a Ford because he was such a darling of Holden at the time. Yeah, it was only a matter of a couple of laps to go. Seaton led the way. Craig had worked him over for a while, got a run coming out of the last corner. That grandstand went absolutely bonkers because Lowndes was this hot property that was the new, wasn't the next big thing. He was the new big thing right there, right now. And that grandstand, I've talked about this before, that Sandown grandstand, when it's packed and it heaves and it roars in response to what's happening on the bitumen in front of it, is uncomparable, I reckon, with almost anything in terms of a permanent Australian motorsport venue, maybe only rivaled by the grandstand at the Adelaide 500 when it lights up when, you know, the winner's coming around or there's a pass for the lead or something like that. But they went bananas. It was absolutely huge. He goes on, wins the race. He and Murphy, you know, win the Sandown 500 that Craig stuffed the year before when he parked it in the sand trap, fighting Glenn, ironically, in the opening laps. And then the momentum was just rolling. Then, of course, the idiot goes and falls off a motocross bike, hooning around, which Wally Weissel, Paul Weissel, the former HRT PR man of the period, he and I spoke about this on the podcast earlier in the year. If you haven't listened to that episode, have a listen because it's inside stories from Holden Racing team history. But then they have to hide Lowndes. They have to make him wear a hat. We're not sure if he's going to drive or not. Oh, God, what's going to happen? But in the end, they get to Bathurst, qualify in the front row, win the race, and the triple threat three-peat is done and dusted.
Yes, ending in a very big hangover the next day.
I was going to say that was the four-peat part of the whole story, yes. But those two nursing those headaches keeled over in the pit lane for a photo shoot the following day with the winning car. And I wrote, it was one of those ones where that Bathurst victory for them, it started wet. Alan Jones challenged, caught on fire in the pack leader Falcon. For the rest of the day, they kind of controlled that race, really. I mean, Murph had a bit of a scary moment where he almost had a Chazzie Mostert on the run to the elbow, which no one saw on TV at the time. He dinged a wall, but he got away with it. It hit it flush, and he managed to carry on and win the race. So Murph's first Bathurst win, Lounsey's first Bathurst win, you know, the perfect year for the Holden Racing team. Who would have guessed at the start of that year that they win those three pillars of Australian touring car racing? It was quite amazing. It's quite unbelievable.
Not just them as a team, but Craig himself is, as like you wind back to the start of 96, you would have thought if any driver was going to do that, maybe it would have been Brock.
Because
he might not have had the raw speed, but he at that point was probably the more proven driver at that point, despite being 51 years young.
He was making errors. He made errors at, you know, Bathurst that year in 96, at Sandown as well. I mean, huge PB fan as a kid, but he wasn't the PB of 86 or 76. By 96, the game had stepped up, so you got punished more for making those sorts of mistakes. But nevertheless, Lounsey was the man. Of course, there was a New Zealand series to finish 96, but it HRT took their older cars over there and Murph drove because Craig was obviously off to Formula 3000 for the following year and doing the International Open Wheeler thing, trying to make it to Formula One. One of the things that I love, so this car is HRT 033. That's its chassis number. It's Denkar chassis number 30. Mm-hmm. So there were Denkar numbers for the shells that they built. Of course, at the time, they built them for other teams as well, not just HRT. Later on, the numbers came in sync and lined up and the Denkar number and the HRT number matched. But it's a cool piece of memorabilia, actually, because when this car had its final crash on the Gold Coast a couple of years later, Robbie Starr, who, of course, worked with Craig Lowndes for many years, he's still at Walkinshaw Andretti United these days, because it was stuffed. It was retired. It was Gonski. Mm. So the chassis plate he put on his toolbox. And later on in time when the car was sold and you know, is being restored with Ben Eggleston's team, it's gone back to the car, which is a really nice thing. So a piece of memorabilia returning to the firewall of that car is pretty cool.
That's really good.
It's a little bit of a way for me to segue to the motorsport trader who keep your motorsport memories alive. They stock all sorts of memorabilia, race suits, panels. No chassis plates for HRT cars, though, I've got to tell you. You can't get any there. themotorsporttrader.com.au, they are keeping your motorsport memories alive. Jump on their website, have a look at some of the cool stuff there because there's, if you've got a man cave or a special space and you're looking for something pretty cool, I reckon you'll find something at the motorsporttrader.com.au. That car, although it didn't race in New Zealand in 96, its work wasn't done in 96, though. So while the New Zealand thing was going on, Thomas tested it at Phillip Island because, of course, the VS was coming, which was just really a spoiler grill update. It wasn't a new car. You could easily turn a VR into a VS. So he was at Phillip Island testing front spoilers on the Bathurst winning car. Chris Lambden drove it, remember, for Motorsport News, for a story at Calder Park. But you had this unique scenario where, taking it back for a second to Bathurst, because of the weather that day, it ruined the Holden PR of that car because, of course, with the windscreen wipers whirring away and the wet weather, it did it on all sorts of cars in that period. It caught, the wipers caught the windscreen banner and sort of, you know, cut a hole out of it, and then eventually it flaked up and flung off. So you had this car crossing the line for its great victory at Mount Panorama in its as-race condition, and the prominent Holden banner signage across the windscreen is gone. Of course, they put it back on for the – I think they put it back on for the photo shoot the next day, didn't they?
And they
the,
sure did.
The appearance on the Sydney Motor Show stand, which was tradition back then when the winning car would go and spend a bit of time at Sydney's Motor Show. But, yeah, it kind of ruins the winner's photo a little bit, doesn't it, when the car isn't as – it kind of is produced as the model car or in the posters or, you know, the winner shot has been kind of de-Holdenized a little bit.
And it was gone early in the day because the start of that race was the wet, probably the wettest part. And I'm pretty sure by its first pit stop, it had the, just had a clean windscreen.
One way to get rid of a bit of signage, but I'm sure Holder would have rather, a bit hard to slap one on at a pit stop in 35 seconds, I would have thought too, just quietly to get that sorted out. But Craig Land's left. So that meant Greg Murphy arrived full-time and this car became his car for the Holden Racing Team. But, of course, he wasn't the reigning champ, so he used the number 15, not the number 1, because that was reserved for Craig, given he was the reigning champion, albeit not defending the crown. And I really loved the 96 livery, but I really liked the 97 livery. More white, some red starting to be introduced with those swirls down the side of that car. Mm. Whoa, that's a tasty livery, that one.
That wasn't the first version of that livery either.
No. No, they had a couple of goes at it, didn't they?
Yeah. So if you look around hard enough, you'll come across a photo of these cars at the HRT cars at Phillip Island early in the season where – or, sorry, prior to the season when they were doing testing. And on the doors where the Mobil logo is, that area was completely white instead of the dark blue all the way across as it ended up.
I reckon it was better how it ended up.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it looked a bit wrong. Call. It looked a bit unfinished, so – but it was very much finished by the time they got into that season. So this is where it sort of goes off the rails very quickly here because I think it's an interesting one. Would you agree that Greg Murphy was, if not the favourite, one of the two or three favourites for the 97 crown, whereas Lowndes kind of hadn't been the favourite? I think there's just so much more expectation on Murph going into that car off the season that the team had had and his wins at Sandown and Bathurst.
Oh, absolutely. Lowndes had fully set the tone for what HRT was capable of now, and Murph had then gone to New Zealand in the older car and swept everyone at Pukekohe and done quite well at Wellington as well. So with Lowndes gone, he was the logical successor to the position of favourite for the championship.
And it started strong. I mean, the Grand Prix at Albert Park was the kickoff, of course, not part of the championship back then. But then I reckon there's things that set tones for things, and the Calder opening round, it was the start of a new era, 1997. It was the debut of V8 Supercars, the brand under Revesco, Channel 10's first round as the broadcaster, you know, Greg's first. It was his championship debut because he'd only driven for HRT in the endurance races the previous 2 years. Mm. So the dream start, pole position first out, happy days. Race one, winner first out, happy days.
And then?
Well, before race one, smashed windscreen. That probably set the tone for something was going to go wrong with this car somewhere along the line because in those days, we talked about it before, the cars were driven a lot of the times by the mechanics, not the drivers, out to the dummy grid, out to the pits. And as part of it, usually they would drive them out onto the track around the short track to bring them back around to line up. Someone left the bonnet pins out of the bonnet, and the thing flew up and smashed the windscreen. Not exactly the best way to start things.
No.
So, and then Murph got muscled by Russell, AJ. Just about everyone had a crack at him and fired one in the door. She was a bit of a bent banana that night, and I think he was seventh in the next two races. And then, of course, Phillip Island, second race, late stages. Tyre lets go coming onto the pit straight off, head on into the earth embankment at about 200 k's an hour, stops pretty suddenly, not much give there, and Murph's, well, bits injured, and Murph's car very injured.
Yeah, that was an era, I think it was soon after that they worked out that, you remember those beautiful six-spoke wheels, the Techno Magnesio ones that HRT was running at the time? They had issues with porosity. So as they would age, they would start cracking and letting air out, and that's what caused the tyre to lose pressure that triggered Murph's accident. And there were a couple of other instances of that happening. And that's why you see later towards the end of the 97 season, HRT goes back to the five spoke wheels.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. That was a big thing at the time because a lot of people used those wheels.
Yeah.
The Techno Magnesios, different colours, different teams.
Yeah, different DJR cars. Ran them as well. They were pretty commonplace then because they were quite light, offer an obvious performance advantage there.
Yeah, so the damage is such that Murph's supercar is parked up and pretty much considered that it's – well, initially it was deemed a write-off, but how many times have we heard of V8 supercars, she's a write-off, yet – yeah. It comes back somewhere, somehow. It's like Lazarus. It rises again, and this car certainly did that. But the ironic thing was Murph needed a spare car to get back into for Sandown. So they had one, the one he'd raced at Pukekohe, which was the car Craig had started 96 in and crashed at Phillip Island. So I think they'd run Murph in that car at the Gold Coast Indy event in 97 before that was before Phillip Island, I'm pretty sure, from memory. Yeah, he ran a spare there, but he had to go back to that car from the Sandown Touring Car round onwards and ran with that one for the rest of the championship. But this car, written off, yes. Salvaged, yes.
Yes.
Denkar brought it back, but not until 1999. And again, it was brought back because of someone who had a big crash.
Ah, yes. So this is when HRT, of course, had moved on to the VT Commodore for Craig Lowndes and Mark Scaife. And the Holden Young Lions team had come back under Holden Racing Team's
operation, kind of, for 99, it was Noske Racing. It was sort of Tony and Mark Noske and Todd Kelly part of it.
But with HRT.
Connected to HRT. They were ex-HRT cars. So Todd Kelly, remember, had that massive shun at Eastern Creek in the first round in 99, went head-on out into the outside wall, and he was in the ex-Brock car. That was the Brock Bathurst car from 96, 97, the sister car to the car we're talking about.
Which was supposed to have a petty bar in it, but it got taken out.
It was in it, and then it was out. Mm. And there's a telltale sign in that car where you can see the little hole, sort of, what would you call it, area where it would bolt into where they cut it out. The little cap is sort of still there. There's a telltale part of that car. So with that one crashed, they wheeled this one back for Todd Kelly from Sandown in 1999. Drove it at Queensland Raceway. That was the inaugural round at Ipswich, remember, when the championship first headed there. And then it went back to the Holden Racing Team to replace a crashed car. There's a common theme in all of this with this car. It either had its crashes or it replaced ones that had crashes. Of course, Craig Lowndes went and barrel rolled himself down the road at Calder after a bit of contact on that start line accident. Also known as the Larry Perkins inspection tour of the underneath of the Lowndes HRT car.
Larry cops a bad rap for that. There were already eight drivers in Craig's door trying to render medical assistance. I don't think a race car driver is the person I'd want to see if I just rolled it. There were worse people, but full marks to Larry for just getting out of the way, letting them figure it out, and also while he's here,
let's have a look underneath these things. Let's see what they got under here. Craig Lowndes was injured. His knee was busted. He was out for Simmons Plains. So the Holden Racing Team wheeled this car, his old car, out for Simmons Plains. Cameron McConville, his Enduro co-driver, filled in. And Craig was back for Winton. Remember, they ran that unique livery at the time. It was kind of the reverse of the VTs.
Well, it was the Young Lions livery.
Yeah.
With a bit more blue on the back.
Yeah, which was pretty cool. Kelly and Noske ran the car as the Young Lions car at the Queensland 500. And then, of course, the teams always wanted to protect their primary cars for Bathurst because Bathurst in those days, 99, was in November. Mm. So the Gold Coast was in October. They wheeled out this VS for Craig Lowndes.
And it really proved the case as to why they need to wheel out an older car.
So he gets in a shunt with Steve Ellery and Garth Tander that damages all the cars. This one, of course, he doesn't have to worry about for Bathurst, but that was it. It was then retired, gone, front damage in the front rail pretty heavily. And I remember going ahead, and I saw this car in 2005, I think it was. I did a story for Muscle Car Magazine about a series of Bathurst winning car stories. And this car was sitting in the disused power station at the Clayton Business Park where the Holden Racing Team were based as a stripped out shell, still with the damaged front chassis rail, just sitting there, stripped of panels, nothing on it, no running gear in it. She was a bare chassis. And it did cross my mind 17 years ago. I wonder what they would want for it. Mm. I wonder if I could afford to buy this car. Then after that, who knows what was going to happen. But as
but it you turned, could have owned a Bathurst winner I would if have the price was right.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure I could have funded the rest of it to put it all back together. But one guy who did was Steve Andrew. He was a Kiwi. He's a Kiwi based on the Sunshine Coast. He bought the car off HRT. He bought some other ones as well. Got the damaged front and rear replaced. And then it was acquired and purchased by Eggleston Motorsport, by Ben and his team, 2016, I think it was. And they've really got stuck into the resto in the last little while in that car. It was sort of eking along, but of course COVID happened, no racing, so they could step up on some of the resto stuff. They've got the Bathurst 1000 winning engine for that car that's been back to Walkinshaw Racing. It's been rebuilt. They took it back also to Clayton to be painted by Walkinshaw's.
That's a cool
where
touch.
It was originally, yeah. Which is, you know, that's really nice synergy. I love these stories of how this stuff all comes together. I had a look at that car about a month or two ago at the Eggleston Team Workshop. It's painted. They're right into a bunch of restos. That's one of them. And we're looking forward to seeing that car completed and finished. And hopefully with Craig Murph behind the wheel at some point to have a run in it, because we know what – we've had Ben Eggleston on the podcast before when we focused in on another HRT car, but – when they do stuff in resto land, they do it really right. They research it meticulously. They use the right parts. Where they don't have the original, they get it replicated by the original fabricator or constructor. They do it properly, and I can't wait to see this finished car.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I can think of a perfect race meeting for that would have Craig Lowndes at it, that would have Greg Murphy at it. You know, it's pretty significant in that it would also be the last time the Bathurst 1000 would be run with Holden's in it.
Oh, you'd be saying like this October for the Repco Bathurst 1000.
Hint, hint, Benny.
I'm sure he's listening. Yeah. I'm sure he's like, yeah, I know.
I'm sure he's already had the idea.
I know the calendar. I'm aware.
Yeah, it's easy to say these things when you're not involved in anything downstream. Yeah,
exactly. It's very funny. It's very easy to lob that one out there. But yeah. Can't wait to see that car returned in its number one. I'm sure it'll be in the Bathurst winning livery. Surely. With the AMP 1000 sticker down the side. And
would you put the Holden banner on the windscreen?
It's pretty hard to replicate the ripped one, or
well, it's just
pretty
not
lazy
there.
To leave the there. Other. Well, no, I'm going for like lap five. You know, you've got to put it there, don't you? It looks weird without it. It looks nude.
Mm.
Oh, you're thinking no.
I think it looks weirder with it.
Really?
Yeah. I'll look at
those. You're wise to how it crossed the line.
Exactly. I'll look at those post-race photos, the PR photos, and think, oh, that looks odd with the Holden banner on the windscreen.
But the people paying millions of dollars for that team probably would disagree with you.
I'm sure they would, but that's how it crossed the line.
True. I mean, and you know what? If they present it like that, you can always say this is how it crossed the line in 96 when it achieved its greatest victory.
Mm.
And look, at the end of the day, I'm sure GM's not going to be giving them any money to stick that sticker on there, so they would be totally justified to do it. Speaking of that car, it did its biggest and best performance at Mount Panorama. And a quick mention, too, to our mates at the National Motor Racing Museum. If you haven't been, you've got to go. It's a ripper. It's open 6 days a week, not on Tuesdays. It's the home to amazing cars, bikes, memorabilia of the mountain. There's a HRT car there, the VT that sat on pole for the FAI 1000 Classic in 1998, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right, with Mark Scaife. But there's a bunch of other cool cars and motorbikes, memorabilia, speedway cars, 12-hour cars. There's plenty there.
Crashed parts on the Wall of Shame.
Yes.
Which was recently added to at the 12-hour.
There was a piece of that Super Barn Audi that crashed in practice, added to the wall before the end of the event weekend. That's how good they are at the museum. If you want to know the opening times, go to the museum's Bathurst website and the National Motor Racing Museum's Facebook page. And by the way, they're the only place with our stock of our Perkins Engineering car history book. So if you haven't got a copy of that book, and of course, if you're a HRT fan, I reckon you're a fair Perkins fan too, because there was a bit of cross-pollination there over the journey, particularly in the early era of LP and HRT. He ran the HRT cars there for a year for the Enduros. If you haven't got the Perkins book, get it and pre-order with us the HRT book as well. If you don't, you'll really regret it.
You will.
Well, because they're limited edition. They're limited number. We only print a certain amount of them. So once we don't do a reprint. Obviously, this is a second edition, but it's not a reprint of the first book. It's different size, lots of different photos, updated chapters. Some elements from that original book are not in this book to protect the value and respect those who bought the first one in terms of full results histories of every HRT car, sister and cousin cars, all sorts of other content. So if you've got the first one, you still really need the second one.
This is true. This is true.
So here's the big question.
Mm-hmm.
If this car is not the greatest Holden Racing Team car of all time, which I think it is, do you think the Golden Child is, or do you have another nomination?
No, I would say Golden Child. Based on that level of success, yes, this car, I do see your point that Golden Child probably doesn't happen without this car, but we're talking about the greatest HRT car of all time. And for me, it's hard to go past Golden Child. And it's red too.
Because of two Bathurst wins?
Two Bathurst wins, two titles.
See, it only did a bit of the work in 01.
Contributed to the title. Mm. Scaife doesn't win the title without that Bathurst. He was in this car when he clinched the title at Pukekohe.
True. Very true. And that's always we have regular mail from our listeners and our readers on our website about what do you deem the championship winning car? Is it the one you're in when you clinch it? Is it the one that did the most work? Is it the one that you won the most races in? Everyone's got a thought and a theory on it. So that's the beauty of life. Everyone's different. Everyone's got a different opinion.
Yeah.
And they're all wrong.
And the beauty of if you own a Craig Lowndes 99 championship winning car, you've got a 1 in 6 chance.
Yeah, exactly right. He used a few to get there, including this car, which is a very special car in terms of Holden Racing Team history, Craig Lowndes history, Holden history, Bathurst history. It's a cool one. The Holden Racing Team supercar VR/VS that won the championship Sandown at Bathurst in 96. It's the latest of our classic cars on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. I think that's us done. It's great to put another car into our garage. Of course, you can listen to all of our previous episodes no matter where you listen to your podcast. In fact, where you're listening to this one right now, we suggest that you can listen to all of our other ones because they're all here, over 200 episodes of the V8 Sleuth podcast. Dating back to 2019, classic cars, Q&As, big sit-down interviews with so many of the names, some of the names that we've actually discussed. There's a Greg Murphy episode, there's a Thomas Mezeran one, there's Paul Weiss of the HRT PR man, a couple of other HRT classic cars. We've done the Golden Child, we did Beth. There's a bit of everything for everyone.
This is true. You can actually hear Ben Eggleston talk about the restoration process involved in Steffi.
Yeah, and that's the... We didn't even mention, too, the nickname of this car, Gabrielle.
Yes.
Gabby. So, I think it was at the time, Tony Fredrickson, who was the new car chief at HRT, named the cars during the era that he was there. Beth was the first one. Mimi was the last one, the last VS that came out for Murph and Craig in 97, the one that's Sandown 500. That's a car for another day and another time. By the way, love that you listen to the podcast. We love the feedback. If you don't subscribe to this podcast, subscribe so you can get the notifications and you don't miss one. Hey, leave a review too. We love hearing from you, or get in touch with our social media or via our website on the Contact Us page. The Motorsport Podcast Network is the overarching umbrella. So it's not just this V8 Sleuth podcast you're listening to that we produce. The Castrol Motorsport News Podcast every Tuesday with the latest in news, views, insights and analysis of Australian world motorsport. Andrew Benlew and Stefan Bartholomaeus, the boys doing a ripper job. And every Thursday generally, sometimes Fridays, depending on if there's some big news cooking, Repco Supercars Weekly with the latest of supercars news, views, notes and quotes. But we're done. We're over. The HRT car can go back into the garage for Dale. Thanks for sitting down with us, and we will chat to you again very soon on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco.